ever it existed. Losing him is painful, but I take great pride in knowing that his sacrifice has helped bring peace to many.
I always remember how committed he was to the resistance. He was fighting for his country and for Syria, aiming for the region to be peaceful. His legacy will continue through the strength of the Iranian forces and the Syrian people.
General Pourhashemi's martyrdom comes amid ongoing efforts by Iran to support Syria in its fight against terrorism. Since 2011, Iran has maintained an advisory mission in Syria at the request of the Syrian government. The Iranian military advisors have been instrumental in assisting Syrian forces reclaim territory and restore security.
Martyr Pourhashemi was not only a great warrior, but also a true man. At a time when our enemies tried to weaken the resistance, he stood firm and sacrificed his life. His blood will not be in vain.
As the country mourns the loss of this brave commander, Iranians remain firm in their support for Syria, signaling that this tragedy will not deter their commitment to regional peace and security.
Martyr Kiomars Pourhashem was not the first, and he will not be the last, as Iran remains steadfast in its support for Syria. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Despite reports of Israeli violations of a ceasefire deal in Lebanon, the people of South Lebanon, the Bekaa, and South Beirut eagerly drove back to their homes. Raising the picture of martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, they returned to collect the pieces, but their resilience was evident in their words.
Our message to Netanyahu and the Israeli enemy is this. No matter what you do, you cannot break our will. And Sayyid Hassan is the crown of our nation, and his blood is more valuable and honorable than anything.
This is a gift from us to all resistance fighters in the Arab and Muslim worlds. We thank God for this victory. There were 70,000 Israeli soldiers at our border, but they could not enter by force, and they will never be able to unarm the resistance.
Hezbollah officials have already begun coordinating with the Lebanese government to begin a new phase of rebuilding.
We will rebuild our homes and we will negotiate with our partners in Lebanon to rebuild the state politically and economically. They failed in 2006 and failed in their so-called plot for a new Middle East. This is in itself a victory despite the suffering, the sorrow, the destruction and displacement. A victory is measured in strategic terms and not the destruction of a house or the loss of our beloved brothers whom we are saddened to miss.
Hezbollah believes the upcoming era will be the beginning of a wider alliance for the people of the region to form a strength that Israel cannot break.
As Hezbollah's resistance concluded what many experts are calling the most brutal battle in its history, the people of Lebanon have begun a new chapter of dusting themselves off and wiping out the traces of the Israeli killing machine. Maryam Saleh from the southern suburbs of Beirut.
For much of the world, it all started on October 7, 2023. But for Iranians, solidarity with Palestinians began with the very birth of the Islamic Republic in 1979. Following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, its then-leader Imam Khomeini wrote a letter inviting Muslims across the world to express their solidarity with Palestinians on the last Friday of every Ramadan, the day he coined as Quds Day. The Iranian nation's belief in standing with oppressed people such as Palestinians is reflected in Article 154 of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, according to which it is a moral duty to support oppressed peoples fighting for their rights. Throughout the years, Iranians have consistently supported Palestine, standing in solidarity with its people in their struggle for rights and justice. Iran does not recognize the illegal occupation of Palestine, and the Iranian parliament has passed several resolutions to provide financial support to Palestinians, admit their displaced students to Iranian universities, and more. This commitment became even more evident after Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza on October 7, 2023. In less than a month, over 10 million Iranians participated in a nationwide campaign to go to Gaza, and the hashtag #YoureDealingWithUs, addressing Israel, went viral. the heartfelt actions of ordinary Iranians have spoken louder than the words of powerful politicians, with countless people showing their support by donating their life savings at numerous grassroots charity events and donation drives.
We will give whatever we have, be it our gold, house, or car. We have started a financial initiative to donate to Palestinians. We will help them in any way we can to free them from the cursed, genocidal Israeli regime.
We have sold whatever we had at home that was barely used at a low price, just so we could donate the proceeds to Palestine.
I came here for the children in Gaza, Palestine, and Lebanon as my leader had commanded, and I have brought some of my allowance for them.
We've held this gathering to give the people around the world the message that the Islamic Republic of Iran and its resilient people support the resistance front and will never stop supporting the oppressed people of Palestine and Gaza, and all of those who are fighting in the resistance front.
And so long as war crimes continue, so will resistance and solidarity with Palestinians.
Maryam Azadcher, Tehran.
A totally unusual moment of happiness in the face of extreme adversity. Aysen has just arrived in the world but doesn't know whether she will live another day. And her family's displacement camp, her mother, who lost her only son, along with other moms and children gathered to celebrate the moment, a sense of sheer euphoria she hopes to last forever. As the cake reads, Aysen's family hopes to find light with her daughter in the midst of complete darkness and bleakness, the other for two children, Maya and Yazan, 13 years old, who the war severely traumatized and deprived of their basic rights, and the mother, embracing her newborn baby, whose eyes haven't yet opened to the injustice of this world, wishes to come back home and escape the incessant horror it chasing her family.
There is a sense of joy here. However, it is not complete as we are in the midst of a war and have been forced to leave our homes. Our lives are simply too difficult. Prices are really high. I have a newborn baby and thinking about how to provide her with milk, diapers, clothes, nourishment. Everything is outrageously expensive here. I even suffered from hunger during pregnancy and childbirth. But I'm very grateful to God for having this girl after my only son was killed.
We've had a great time celebrating our birthdays. I'm eager to return to my home in Gaza City. We wish to return to our hometowns and schools. This war will eventually come to an end, God willing.
Newborn Aysen and the twin children, Maya and Yazan, don't know if they will live for the next days. But the war in Gaza, which killed more than 43,000 Palestinians, mostly children and women, and wounded over 105,000 others, has never changed the resilience and steadfastness of the Palestinian people. And the happiness we've just lived today with those people is a reflection of eternal hope they have been always clinging on to. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
As temperatures drop in Gaza, displaced Palestinians living in makeshift tents with little food or warm clothes are bracing for the approaching winter, the second since the war began. Hundreds of thousands of families are trapped under uninterrupted Israeli strikes hitting every corner of the coastal strip.
We didn't find any other place but this one after we were displaced from northern Gaza and then from Rafah. We call on those who are still conscientious to look at us and stand with us. Unfortunately, the entire world has let us down. Honestly, living here on the beach this winter is more horrible than the war itself.
The heavy rain has also flooded the tents of the displaced in different parts of the Gaza Strip. While some Palestinians managed to retrieve their children from the sea, their lives were in ruins when the high tidal waves swept over their flimsy makeshift tents.
Suddenly, we lost everything, our tents, belongings, and tarps.
Our tent was sheltering 15 people, including my daughters and their children. Look, our children barely survived the heavy rains and strong waves. They only have the pieces of clothing they're wearing. We don't know what to do or where to go. No one cares about us.
Nearly 14 months of Israeli genocide in Gaza has reduced the coastal strip to ruins and rubble. Palestinians are trapped under brutal bombardments, facing unbearable starvation, and now perishing weather conditions.
With the harsh winter looming to make the humanitarian crisis in Gaza even worse, only an end to the war could offer the displaced Palestinians real hope. Israel's deadly assault, however, continues with no sign of ending, while the whole world remains silent on the ongoing genocide in Gaza. The middle area of Gaza Strip.
Places of worship have been highly sensitive in the Indian subcontinent since the 1947 partition. In India, disputes over them are frequently exploited for political gain, playing on voter sentiments. On Sunday, a survey of the centuries-old Grand Mosque in Uttar Pradesh Sambal district sparked deadly clashes, claiming 5 lives. Hindu groups claim the mosque was built on a destroyed temple during Mughal rule, while Muslim groups are fighting related legal cases in various courts. In recent years, Hindu groups in many states have filed numerous lawsuits alleging that mosques were built on erased Hindu temples during the Mughal era.
Sunday's incident has reignited fears of violence over a sensitive religious dispute in the world's most populous nation, which is marred by the history of communal carnage after the partition of India in 1947, at the end of British rule.
Hindu activists and groups, many affiliated with Prime Minister Modi's ruling party, claim several mosques were built on the sites of centuries-old Hindu temples razed by the Mughal Empire. Observers note these groups have grown bolder since the recent inauguration of a controversial Hindu temple built on the site of a Babri mosque in Ayodhya, destroyed by a Hindu mob on December 6, 1992. Muslim groups denounce this as a violation of the Places of Worship Act 1991, despite lower courts ordering such surveys, and are calling for Supreme Court intervention.
This drive has been ongoing since the demolition of the Babri mosque. It's been a deliberate political agenda since 1990. Unfortunately, even the court judgment failed to serve justice, despite the lack of evidence proving the Babri Mosque was built after razing a temple. This is all a political conspiracy by communal forces.
Prominent Muslim scholars condemned the recent violence, calling it a clear example of lawlessness, injustice and cruelty. Activists echoed this sentiment, stating that the ruling party aims to reduce Muslims to second-class citizens with limited civil liberties, unable to even protest for their constitutionally guaranteed fundamental rights.
We have to understand that these are essential elements of the ideology of Bharatiya Janata Party, and all these acts are aimed at marginalizing Muslims and criminalizing all aspects of their life and to restrain their living. That is the ideology of Bharatiya Janata Party. We have to understand it, and therefore we call it fascism.
Rights activists and observers say that since the ruling party came to power in 2014, Muslims have faced systematic repression, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the new citizenship law, and now the push for a uniform civil code and the seizure of Muslim charitable properties waqf. Activists say the aim is to disempower Muslims as a part of a larger political agenda to create a unified Hindu first India. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello. The recent resurgence of tourism in Syria, led by the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group, began with a surprise offensive in late November targeting the city of Aleppo. This offensive has coincided with the Israeli regime's agreement to a ceasefire with Lebanon. The issue has sparked an important debate. Is Israel exacerbating the conflict by aligning with militant factions and terrorists? I am Bahman Nurai, your host, and in this edition of Spotlight, we delve into the multifaceted dynamics of Israel's involvement in Syria and its implications for regional stability. First, let us watch this report.
The recent resurgence of terrorism in Syria, led by the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group, began with a surprise offensive in late November, targeting the city of Aleppo. This offensive resulted in the capture of several towns and villages, coinciding with the Israeli regime's agreement to a ceasefire with Lebanon. Far from being a coincidence, many believe that Israel is avenging its loss in Lebanon and Gaza through its support for the resurgence of terrorism in Syria. Just 48 hours before the Aleppo attack, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned Syrian President Bashar al-Assad not to provoke Israel, specifically regarding arms transfers to Hezbollah through Syrian territory. Over the past year, Israel has conducted more than 70 strikes in Syria, targeting border crossings deemed routes for arms transfer to Hezbollah, as well as the group's warehouses and facilities within Syrian territory. This illegal aggression has created an opportunity for terrorist groups to advance across the Arab country, particularly as the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah is recovering from its recent war with Israel. Syria's support for the resistance front has long irritated Israel, which has occupied the Golan Heights since the 1967 war. This support was underscored in a speech by the late Hamas political bureau leader Yahya Sinwar.
For the construction of Quds Axis, we will reconcile with Assad's Syria, which is one of our key allies in the Levant. We will strengthen our relations with Hezbollah, which is the main arm in the Levant, and in order to expand the field of resistance in Yemen and Iraq, we need to broaden our relations.
Osama Hamdan, head of the international relations for Hamas, had also elaborated on the matter, highlighting the strategic importance of Syria for resistance groups.
The Syrian position that is clearly expressed is a position of support for the Palestinian people and their resistance, whether on the official level or on the level of Syrian media. But everyone knows what happened to Syria during the past decade, and this had an impact on Syria's abilities. We cannot forget the Syrian position and the Syrian effort over decades that have passed before the last decade. How Syria supported the resistance and how it stood by the side of the resistance and how it endured the support of the resistance. In this time period, we believe that what happened to Syria may not have allowed it to play the same role.
Syria has time and again accused Israel of aiding terrorist groups like Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and highlighted the suspicious timing between Israeli airstrikes and subsequent terrorist attacks on government-held areas. The Syrian government had previously managed to defeat terrorist groups through coordinated military offensives and airstrikes, often with support from allies like Russia and Iran. Following the surprise terrorist attack on November 27, the government has now launched a robust counteroffensive to reclaim lost territories and eliminate terrorist threats.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political commentator from London. And Saib Shah, West Asia expert from Belfast.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. It is very great to have you and thank you for your time. Allow me to introduce Fit Hafsa first. Long time haven't seen you here on the program. How does the timing of Takfiri's insurgents in Syria correlate with the recent ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, you think?
I think it's very related, and it confirms what many of us have been saying about these groups for over a decade, which is that they're part and parcel of the Israeli regime apparatus. They have consistently operated to serve Israel's interests, and I think nowhere has this been more blatant than this most recent attack on Halab. Now, I think it's important to remind viewers that over the past year, where we've seen absolute carnage in Palestine and in Lebanon, when we've seen over 70 mosques destroyed and flattened in Gaza, but also places of Christian worship, both in Palestine and Lebanon, these groups, these supposedly Muslim groups, these groups calling themselves Muslims, haven't lifted a finger to aid their fellow Muslim and Arab brothers very often. And yet today have been incredibly effective in destroying and attacking and weakening a predominantly Arab and predominantly Muslim country. So I think this is a confirmation of their status as part of the Israeli apparatus. And of course, the timing, as ever, has always coincided with Israeli interests.
Well, Saeb, great to have you again on the program. We have heard it a lot that the Israelis believe that they have worn down resistance axis, Hezbollah and other parts of the resistance axis in the region. Do you believe, you know, what advantage can Israel gain from these rebel groups, these insurgent groups in Syria right now, the Takfiris and terrorists?
You'll allow me, we'll take a few minutes to explain that. First of all, these groups, I just want to say that to the Western media or linked media within in the region, designated the groups by the United Nations Security Council as terrorist groups, especially Jabhat Tahrir al-Sham and al-Nusra. Since the invasion of the United States of America to Iraq, and the list the Americans have in their hands, which is researched and edited by Netanyahu and the Zionist entity of leaders and country, the United States of America, got to destroy, to secure the existence of the State of Israel, since these countries are supportive of the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance. And the top of the list was Syria. In 2004, the Syrians were threatened directly by George W. Bush to fall in line and to stop supporting the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance and to kick out the Palestinian presence in Syria from the resistance. Otherwise, he will be punished. Syria at the time, Colin Powell, who carried the message to Assad. Assad asked him to leave, and Assad stayed the course with the resistance. And we've seen after that, 2005, the Palestinian resistance managed to liberate Gaza and it cleansed the Zionist entity out. 2006, then the United States of America gave order to the Zionist entity to invade Lebanon. They went with massive bombardment against Dahiya of Beirut, the suburb of Beirut, and then the land invasion. And they wanted to form kind of vice grip around from Lebanon, around Syria, the Americans in Iraq and the Israelis through Lebanon. They were shocked to the core by the strength of the Belize resistance who destroyed the Israelis invasion at the time. And that plan for the new Middle East again at that time is just been defeated. Since then, the United States of America brought these Takfiri groups during the Arab Spring to tackle all the regimes which they see they are not following the Americans' kind of doctrine in the region, and they are not allies of it, like Syria. Before that, of course, they took Iraq, and then Libya, and all of that. We see what these Takfiri groups done in Syria is unbelievable. But Syria stayed the course with the support of the Lebanese resistance, the Palestinian resistance, Iran, Russia as well. And that, the same itself, we've seen after that 90% of the Syrian resources fell under the occupation, under American occupation, gas, oil, wheat, all of that. And we seen groups, these Takfiri groups, managed to steal and transfer through Turkey the Syrian gas and oil to the Zionist entity itself, where even less than 10% of the cost, they get the Syrian fuel to them. And this as well bring us to 24 right now, when the resilience of the Lebanese resistance and the Palestinians expose the weakness of this Zionist entity. And Netanyahu went in seeking for a ceasefire after the Black Sunday. The Black Sunday, when 4 million of the population and that entity went underground, and the port of Umm Sdud near Gaza to Haifa in the north were dismantled by barrage and salvos of rockets. That shook Netanyahu, and he exercised some more pressure. He wanted that ceasefire. And then he came and warning Assad of playing with fire, since Syria was the hub of supplying the chain, the controller of the supply chain to the resistance, the research centers of the resistance in Syria, the manufacturing. Today, the Takfiri groups declared they captured around Halab, Aleppo, a complex of military complex for producing rockets and ammunition, which was used for supplying the resistance in Lebanon or in Palestine. So we know the target is the Zionist entity's security, in short.
Right, thank you. Now I'm going to go back to Hafsa. You know, you heard what Saeb was telling us about the warning of Bashar al-Assad by Netanyahu 48 hours before the Aleppo strike. What do you think, you know, is the actual gain, you know, because we all know that Bashar al-Assad is a supporter and backer of resistance axis in the region and has never backed down in his support. You know, why Israel believes that it can actually gain something by supporting these terrorist groups right now in Syria? Because, you know, capturing and getting areas is one thing, and holding to them is something else. I don't think they can hold on to those areas. What is the gain in there for Israel?
Well, I think first and foremost is obviously to weaken Syria as much as it possibly can. And of course, Syria is going to be distracted by this attack on its northern territory. So that's a reality that is undeniable. The other thing I think you have to acknowledge is that the Israelis, by doing this, are literally signaling to the Muslim world that they can activate supposedly Islamic cells any way and anywhere they want. They're literally coming out of the closet and recognizing that they can manipulate and they control these groups. So I think this is a way for Netanyahu to threaten the rest of the Muslim world, to tell them that they can unleash their dogs on the rest of the Muslim world as they please. And we've been saying this for many years. Many have called those who called out these groups as conspiracy theorists, or they've accused others of being sectarian because they're essentially Sunni Muslim groups. But the facts are now very telling. It is absolutely clear that these people work for Israeli interests. And Israel is now coming out and literally, quite literally, admitting to controlling these groups. And it's a way for Netanyahu to say, well, we have the power not only to attack, and of course we have the power of being backed by the United States, military power, but we also have the power to unleash these terrorist militias on any country that we please around the region. So I think this is a threat not only to Syria, but to the wider Muslim world, to tell them that these groups are actually under the control of Israel and can be activated as Israel pleases.
And Hafsa, how do you think the situation in Syria right now could kind of spill over to other regional countries? You know, because that is actually playing with the fire for regional countries who are kind of supporting this. How can they contain this within Syria?
Well, I think this should be a wake-up call for the wider region, because Netanyahu has started to work on his Greater Israel plan. He's been saying it, and now he's actually working on it. Now, the part of the plan includes going as far as way into modern-day Saudi Arabia. That's how far the greater Israel plan goes. And I think that these groups have the power to aid Israel in going as far as. And so I think that Arab countries that have either been okay with Israel or have normalized with Israel, such as Dubai, Bahrain, etc., but also countries like Saudi Arabia, who have been in talks to normalize and who have not, momentarily suspended talks, but they are still planning on returning to the negotiating table with Israel in order to normalize relations. I think these countries, and in particular Saudi Arabia, which is quite large and important in the region, has the power to stop this. The fact that they don't, I think, would also go as far as confirming that within the Saudi monarchy, there are acquaintances with the Zionist regime. I think that's been a suspicion for long enough. But I think if they do not react to this incursion in Arab territory and to this blatant recognition that these groups do work for the Zionist regime, then they're preparing, if you will, the establishment of a greater Israel, and they're confirming their complicity with Israel. So I think this is also a testing time for countries like Saudi Arabia to intervene and stop this, or aid Syria, or stop funding of groups that are associated to these Takfiri groups. Because actually, although today Syria is the main target for the obvious reasons that my colleague has stated, and of course their support of the resistance, I think the long-term plan of Israel is to widen their territory through these groups and aid in the creation of the greater Israel plan.
Thank you, Hafsa. Very interesting that you mentioned the Arab countries in the region. Now, going back to you, Saeb, we had today the Arab League supporting Syrian government against terrorism, and they say that the Syrian government's sovereignty must stay put, and they supported Syria in this. We remember that in 2011, they all had the position and the stance against Bashar al-Assad in power. Why the change of position right now, especially we had UAE also in particular talking in support of Bashar al-Assad's government?
You see, at the time, Barack Obama, on the back of the Arab Spring, he brought two models to the region, the Pakistani military model or the Turkish Islamic secular model. And he threw that, and the Arabs and the Ottomans run with that, which the new Ottoman, Erdogan and his gang, and started the Arab Spring, thinking with the backing of the Americans, they're going to bring back the Ottoman Empire. And the Zionists and the Americans were using the Takfiri groups and the fanatic religious groups and telling them, yes, you can have your pro-Western, of course, Islamic Khilafah in the area. The same thing was in 1954 when they tried to create what they called the Baghdad Alliance, which is part of the Cold War against, at the time, the Soviet Union against the Arab Liberation Movement, which we in the region answered that at the time with Bandung in Indonesia, and start forming the third world countries wave of liberation against imperialism and independent line, non-alliance line with the West or with the East. And that continued. So today they try to bring that at the time of Obama with a new dress to put the whole region under control. Let's remember one fact. Syria as a government, as a state, is part of the Arab Liberation Movement, were developed in the 50s and the 60s. So Syria regime is came on the back as part of the Arab Liberation Movement, exactly like the Palestinian resistance at the time, came as anti-imperialist, anti-Zionist for the liberation of Palestine. The Ba'ath Party in Syria, a flag is the Palestinian flag. This is the state. So this country is targeted as part of the liberation movement, the resistance. Syria always entrenched in that. Since this is why you can see Arabic regimes, reactionary Arabic regimes, as my colleague rightly mentioned, Saudi and Gulf State and all of that, were using tons of money to bribe the survivors of the American attacks after the invasion of Iraq to line up with them against the wave of radical Arabic regimes, they said. They eliminated Gaddafi in Syria. They killed the man who was 100% behind the Palestinian resistance. They tried to do the same in targeting all the leadership in Damascus when they blew the security gathering at the time. Assad survived that attack. They threw mayhem and devastation in the region. They don't care how many millions being displaced and around the world cannot find refuge. Those Arabic countries, the Prime Minister of Qatar alone, he said, they invested in an article and an interview with the Qatari TV, not Al Jazeera, the official Qatari TV, said nearly 180 billion at the time Qatar is spent on in Syria. Imagine if you spend that much money in Syria to destroy it. If you spend that money in Asia and Africa alone, you'll make it a new tigers of industry countering the West. So this is the mentality, because they were directed, these states, by the United States of America and by the Zionist entity. The most important thing is to secure the existence of the Zionist entity, Israel. So these countries today, they are back. They seem they are weakened. A lot of the Muslim fanatic groups, especially like the Emirates or others. So they think aligning themselves right with secular state is better for them.
Thank you, Saeb. Now, getting back to Hafsa, you know, as Saeb just mentioned also, regional players. I'm going to also talk a little bit about that. But, well, you know, this operation that they had against Aleppo and Idlib, you know, it must have had months of training. It is not like they just woke up and did the operation. And it was surprising in matters of, like, the amount of land that they gained in a matter of days. What's, you know, we've had Turkey supporting anti-Israeli moves within the United Nations Security Council also. What's in it in Turkey in this? Because could we say that Turkey is also aligning with Israel in this matter in particular? And what's in it for them?
Well, I think Turkey has been an active player in this from the start. Definitely since the start of the attacks on Syria. It's played a major role. It supported the ousting of Gaddafi. It supported the ousting of Bashar al-Assad and has played an active role. It had at some point take a step back because, of course, within the region between, or the shared region between Syria and Turkey, you had the emergence of Kurdish group. And I think that Turkey felt threatened with that. So it needed to take a step back. But they have been working in destabilizing Syria from day one. We know that Erdogan claims to support the Palestinian cause in verbally, but of course, in terms of action, does nothing. He never even interrupted the relations. I mean, just very recently and very symbolically. But of course, we know that the oil that fuels the jets that are pounding Gaza and Lebanon as we speak actually transit through the pipelines that go through Turkey and get Turkish approval. So the role of Turkey is very blatant here. It's difficult to state. I mean, I don't think that Turkey envisaged a sort of the return of the Ottoman Empire. I think they're reasonable enough. But we're seeing the emergence of very bizarre groups. We've seen with the normalization of Israel through the Abraham Accords, the rise of what we can only describe as Arab Zionism. And now we're seeing a very strange alliance between Islamists and actual Kemalist groups. Kemal, you know, based on the theories of Mustafa Kemal, who was an active Islamophobe. And so we're seeing an alliance between a sort of Kemalo-Islamism that is born in Turkey out of this very racist and fascistic, racist Turkish nationalism, allying with these takfiri groups claiming to be Islamic. And I think that obviously it is designed to extend Turkish influence around the region and impose itself as a powerful player in the region. And the sad thing, of course, is that whilst Turkey plays the Muslim card, it is actually actively behaving and actively contributing to the weakening and the killing and the destruction of Muslim countries and therefore the death of Muslim people.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Hafsa. Thank you, Saeb, for your insights. Unfortunately, we just ran out of time. I would love to continue this conversation with you. It was a real joy. So thank you, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political commentator from London, and also Saeb Shah, West Asia expert from Belfast. Again, thank you. This was another Spotlight. Thank you.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Donald Trump has threatened 100% tariffs against BRICS nations if they act to undermine the US dollar. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. President-elect Donald Trump on Saturday, 30th of November, threatened 100% tariffs against a bloc of nine nations if they act to undermine the US dollar. His threat was directed at countries in the so-called BRIC alliance, which consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, and the United Arab Emirates. Turkey, the Republic of Azerbaijan and Malaysia have applied to become members, and several other countries have expressed interest in joining the bloc. While the US dollar is by far the most used currency in global business and has survived past challenges to its preeminence, members of the alliance and other developing nations say they're fed up with America's dominance of the global financial system. The dollar represents roughly 58% of the world's foreign exchange reserves, according to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and major commodities like oil are still primarily bought and sold using dollars. The dollar's dominance is threatened, however, with BRICS' growing share of gross domestic product GDP and the alliance's intent to trade in non-dollar currencies, a process known as de-dollarization. Donald Trump, in a Truth Social post, said, "We require a commitment from these countries that they will neither create a new BRICS currency nor back any other currency to replace the US dollar, or they will face 100% tariffs and should expect to say goodbye to selling into the wonderful US economy." At a summit of BRICS nations in October, Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the United States of weaponizing the US dollar and described it as a big mistake. President Putin said, "It is not us who refuse to use the dollar, but if they don't let us work, what can we do? We are forced to search for alternatives." Russia has specifically pushed for the creation of a new payment system that would offer an alternative to the global bank messaging network SWIFT and allow Moscow to dodge Western sanctions and trade with partners. Donald Trump said there is no chance that BRICS will replace the US dollar in global trade, and any country that tries to make that happen should wave goodbye to America. Donald Trump's latest tariff threat comes after he threatened to slap 25% tariffs on everything imported from Mexico and Canada, and an additional 10% tax on goods imported from China, as a way to force the countries to do more to halt the flow of illegal immigration and drugs into the United States. Trump has since held a call with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, who said on Thursday she is confident that a tariff war with the United States can be averted. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau returned home on Saturday after meeting Trump without assurances that the president-elect will back away from threatening tariffs on Canada. British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story. US President-elect Donald Trump on Saturday, 30th of November, threatened tariffs of 100% against the so-called BRICS countries unless their governments agree not to create a new currency as an alternative to the US dollar. The idea that the BRICS countries are trying to move away from the dollar while we stand by and watch is over, Trump wrote in a post on the Truth Social platform on Saturday afternoon. The group is made up of primarily of Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, but has recently expanded to include Iran, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Argentina, Egypt and Ethiopia. Although the US dollar is the most used currency in global business and trade, BRICS nations such as Russia and China have called for the bloc to challenge the dollar's status as the world's reserve currency. A proposal for a BRICS currency was introduced at last year's summit in South Africa. Donald Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform on Saturday, "We require a commitment from these countries that they will neither create a new BRICS currency nor back any other currency to replace the US dollar, or they will face 100% tariffs and should expect to say goodbye to selling into the wonderful US economy." In October, Russian President Vladimir Putin accused Western powers of weaponizing the US dollar, arguing at a BRICS summit in Kazan in Russia that sanctions against Russia were not working. The threats of steep tariffs against US imports from the countries follow similar threats made to Mexico, Canada and China earlier this week, as Donald Trump signals that he intends to use punitive measures to force US trading partners to comply with his demands. Trump said he would impose tariffs of 25% on all imports from Canada and Mexico, and an extra 10% on Chinese goods imported into the United States, accusing the countries of permitting illegal migration and drug trafficking. Those threats raised the possibility of countermeasures from Mexico and prompted a hurried visit to Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Friday evening, 29th of November. Donald Trump won a convincing electoral victory earlier this month after campaigning on a pledge to issue sweeping tariffs on foreign goods imported to the United States, including an extra 60% on Chinese goods.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. Not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. But through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Tonight, a blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headline: Syria's armed forces continue to fight foreign-backed terrorist groups in the northwestern part of the country, inflicting heavy losses on them. Iran's president says Tehran will do all in its power to counter terrorists in Syria and will coordinate its efforts with